A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 on two beds pushed together here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phil Iscove.
And with us today is our favorite guest, no guest!
Kenny's favorite guest.
Love it. I get to really let my freak flag fly.
Especially for this movie. You know, it's funny, we've talked about a lot of these movies for a long time. As we get to the end of our run, these movies are movies that have been on the list for the longest amount of time, right? Like, that's just kind of how it is. And this is a film that I remember seeing in 99 relatively vaguely.
How did you see this? What's the story of that?
Like, I honestly saw it because I worked at a video store. And it was a movie that... got a little bit. I think that what's interesting about this film and the itch that this film scratches for 99, I think is a somewhat compelling one, which is that it's an independent movie made for, you know, $500,000 made for $500,000. And, you know, by two brothers, the Polish brothers, Mark and, forgive me,
Michael,
kind of made a splash, I believe, in the sort of Sundance-y independent, you know, film festival circuit, what have you. And it comes out, I'm in my first year of film school. And you mentioned this, you texted me this, Kenny, that, like, I think you'll like this movie. And I do think that we're going to hit pause for a sec here, Will.
Not leaving. You know, I just have to let my dog in and out. Sorry.
Okay. This movie still does kind of speak to me on a aesthetic level, on a thematic level, you know, in terms of it being sort of this odd... I don't want to say freaky, but like there is kind of, you know, Siamese Twins is its own thing. So I was compelled to watch it because of its subject matter. And I remember thinking that it looked really cool and that Michelle Hicks is beautiful. These are the things that jumped out at me when I saw it in 99. And I certainly didn't hate it, but I don't think that it kind of made a huge impression on me. I did watch Northfolk years later when they put out, the Polish brothers put out their second film.
I think that was a third.
And I remember thinking, I don't know that there's a lot here. Like, I don't know that if these guys are actually, you know, if there's going to be a long career here. And I don't mean that in a shitty way.
Seems like you were right.
They just kind of, there's a vibe, and I don't know that there's much more than a vibe to sort of what they're going for. It's kind of Lynchian. It's kind of quirky. And rewatching this film the other day, I went on kind of an emotional journey with the movie. And by the end of it, really kind of came around on it a lot more than I did in the beginning. But what was your sort of 30,000 feet impression of the movie?
My 30,000 feet impression of the movie was I absolutely loved it. I think it's a beautiful film, a brilliant film. It's not exploitative in a way that would have made me uncomfortable.
Totally.
It's sensitive. And, you know, I think what's interesting about the Lynchian vibes is it does feel like you're walking into a Lynchian world in the beginning until you meet them. And then it kind of stops.
I totally,
you know, it's almost like, and I want to galaxy brain this a little bit and be like, that's on purpose. You know, there is this, like, you know, this thing that, like, oh no, this is, these people aren't, excuse me, freaks. These people are people, you know, these people don't exist just to, like, you know, put you normies into some uncomfortable situation.
Sure.
And they're also not being exploited the way, like, you know, I would say like Rocky Dennis is in Mask,
or Todd Browning's Freaks to some degree or another,
which is its own thing. And 1930, it's a like different kind of idea. Yeah. But I mean, Todd Browning's Freaks is probably, in a sense, the spiritual ancestor to this, because that movie is about giving those people some agency and, you know, showing but that they're kind more of than
turning them into monsters a little bit at the end. But, you know,
well,
deserves
it. A little bit. She's terrible. Killer.
I absolutely agree with you. I think that this movie is very tender about its characters, which is incredibly important. I think that, you know, at the end of this film, I found myself thinking like what the Polish Brothers version of Geek Love would be, the Catherine Dunn book, which is a tremendous book, a dark, fucked up book about carnies, I think they do an interesting job with. Like, I think Geek Love is one of those books that everyone kind of, Tim Burton had the rights to for a million years and just didn't kind of figure it out.
Tell me a little bit about Geek Love. I don't know about Geek Love.
It's basically about this couple that essentially does kind of, perverse things in order to have children that are mutated in some form or another in order to sort of populate this carnival. It's a really dark book. You know, you look at Nightmare Alley. I don't know if you've seen it yet, but like seeing what Del Toro did with the whole carny world there, again, very lovingly done, but also kind of done in that kind of look at how twisted and weird this world is sort of way. I appreciated that this movie, first of all, that's a grace note that these twins were even in that universe, and then it's done at the end, as opposed to us sort of getting the
in a different kind of way. They weren't totally they weren't gawk at these freaks. It is like these guys are like really talented, but they it wasn't even that they were talented. It was that they just did something like the scene where they play the guitar is like remarkable, because they just did something that just felt so pure and
Like the shitty version of this movie, there's like a poster for their act in the hotel room. You know what I mean? And and like there's some sort of an allusion to that before we even get to it at the very end of the movie. I appreciated that this movie is small, that this movie's intimate. To some degree, that's demanded by its budget, but still, I think that like this movie, this movie's a bit of a high wire act in a way that I respect that they even tried to do it. I agree.
This is one of those movies. This is a one in a hundred movie where a lot of people have ideas like this. Mm-hmm. And if you fuck it up, yep, you're done. Like you're done. No one's going to talk to you anymore. And the performance of the two Polish brothers, mm-hmm, it's remarkable.
It is.
Like it, they actually feel like a joined, mm-hmm, conjoined twins.
Yeah.
In it, you know, just the, and I, you know, I have twins. I know like the relationship that twins have with each other is different. My twins, you know, have a familiarity and a comfort level with each other that I have never had with anybody. Right. Like, including my wife. It's like, it's just a different thing. You know, it's well,
they share.
Yeah. Chromosomes. They've always been together. Right. Like I have a sister who's 2 years younger than me, and it's nowhere near the bond that they have, just in terms of like the comfort level, like the, mm-hmm, the just ease, the way they prefer to be in the same room doing nothing versus being in their own rooms doing nothing. Yeah. That's a very interesting, unique thing, I think, for boy and girl. Okay. So I understand how these two twins, real life twins, Mark and Michael, are able to give this performance, but I think it is kind of shocking to actually see it happen in real life. The way that Francis, who's the sicker of the two Siamese twins, there's Blake and Francis, and Blake is kind of the healthy one who has the stronger heart, and Francis is the weaker one who is essentially being kept alive by Blake's ability to punch, to push blood through both of their bodies. Francis spends most of the movie with his head on Blake's shoulder, right? And his like mouth up against Blake's neck. That is not something that I think a lot of actors would even understand how to play.
Yeah.
You know, because you've seen conjoined twins in movies and Burton movies and things like that, and they usually stand upright. And, you know, there's just like Tweedledee and Tweedledum aspect to them. But that's the fact that there are so few conjoined twins who live to adulthood in human history, there really isn't much of a understanding of how it would go. But mm-hmm, after seeing this, I couldn't imagine anything else.
Yeah, we've seen conjoined twins stuff before. And it's really tough. This is a hard, I mean, to your point, I feel like if I'm not emotionally engaged in the two of them, it feels like, you know, shock for the sake of shock, right? It feels like just, a plot device. And yes, to their credit, they are, it's really beautiful and sad. And what they're able to convey just with body language is pretty unreal.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, you said it really well about the beginning, which is you come into this film, you know, we meet Penny, and she's a prostitute in the back of a cab. She's been called to this hotel room in this seedy hotel that feels very Lynchian, Barton Fink-esque, of just sort of this very kind of weird
I did have that twinge of like, what if the Coens did this movie?
You know? Right. She knocks on the door. I also, it needs to be said that, you know, this is Michelle Hicks' first film. She's never acted before. She's a model up until this point. And this is not an easy role. This movie is a lot of it's on her shoulders. Mm-hmm. And I would argue,
it's her story. Know,
yeah. And I don't know that she's totally up to the task for the first little bit of the film. I don't know if they shot it chronologically or not, but she gets much stronger as the film progresses.
I agree with you.
So up top, I remember as I watched it yesterday, I was like, I don't know. Some of this is feeling leaden. Her dialogue is just not really flowing. A lot of this is just on her aesthetic, which is, I mean, she is a very attractive
not
woman.
Not a lot of people look like her.
No one looks like her. She's got this very kind of gothic, you know, crazy dark huge eyeliner around her eyes and just like, mm-hmm. is very sort of arresting to look at.
Yeah. Dark hair, blue eyes. You just don't see it very often.
Yeah.
And she's just really, really striking. I mean, you know, as I said to you, she was in the Shield and having seen her in the Shield and kind of understanding her acting style, it wasn't so jarring for me. This is kind of who she is, but
yeah, it's very, and the first impression you get of the Blake and Francis is not what you expect, to your point, right? Like, there is a version of this movie that continues on the road it's on from the beginning, right? Where it's like Siamese twins living in a creepy hotel and like really sort of dialing all of that up, and instead it's a pretty compassionate character piece about you know, literal emotional, you know, attachment. It's pretty interesting. There's a very brief synopsis on Google that said a kind-hearted woman falls in love with a man who's physically joined to his dying twin brother, and she begins to take care of both of them. I mean, that is the synopsis, I guess. This movie opened on June 30th, 1999 against Runaway Bride, Blair Witch, Deep Blue Sea, and The Haunting. As I mentioned, it had a budget of $500,000. It went on to make a little over $1 million, which, you know, is impressive, all things considered. It's got 78% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 84% from audiences. I'm going to read Roger Ebert gave it a 4-star review. He said, it is one of those films not much interested in plot, but it's fascinated by what it's like to be somebody or two somebodies. The movie doesn't depend on special effects to create a shared body and instead uses the performances. Mark and Michael Polish seem constantly to be confiding in each other. Indeed, when you spend your life within inches of another person's ear, you learn to murmur. We can imagine their lifetime of isolation from the normal things people do. And there's a heartbreaking dream shot towards the end of the film, just showing two boys riding bicycles. I have a special feeling for movies that want to forget about plot and conflict and spend their time instead in regarding particular lives, like Pi or Happiness. This film is a meditation on the situation of its characters. There's no payoff, no answer, no solution, no resolution, because how can there be? You are who you are. Life either goes on or it doesn't. The key bond in the film seems to be between the brothers, but then we realize their bond is given, not chosen, and doesn't mean as much as the bond between the two of them and Penny. Her business is to minister to the lonely and the needy, and these two boys make her feel so helpless that her own solitude is exposed. In its quiet, dark, claustrophobic way, this is one of the best films of the year.
That's one of those reviews that remind you why this guy was the best,
right?
And it's funny because I did read that review, and the movie I kept thinking of all films that this reminded me of was Breaking the Waves. And part of that might be because I watched it, you know, it's really only available. It's available on YouTube.
Yes.
Or and was Crackle. It available on like Crackle.
On Crackle.
Of course, Crackle. Chicken Soup for the Soul Media loves the Polish brothers. But it's available. Did you watch it on Crackle?
I did.
How was the transfer on Crackle?
It was actually great. It was better than the YouTube one.
YouTube one was shit.
Yeah.
And so maybe it was because I watched it on Crackle, because Breaking the Waves kind of has like a memorably horrible, grainy look to it.
What's it shot on video?
Except for these
gorgeous chapter shots.
Yes.
Where Lars von Trier basically is saying, see, I can make it look pretty. I'm choosing not to.
So I don't know if this was shot on video, though I'm sure it wasn't. And no, this was also shot on film. It also doesn't behoove this movie to do that anyway. That being said, Breaking the Waves is largely about a person ministering to a person in bed. And
it's true. That movie's it's a hard movie, man.
And trying to figure out how to help this person through their last moments, more or less. And Breaking the Waves was a sensation. A kind of pre-indie boom sensation, right? The boom happened, I think.
What year is Breaking the Waves? I'm just looking.
I think it's 94.
I think it is too.
And I would say the real boom was 96.
It's 96.
It was 96. So it was right in that pocket
with you know, Secrets and Lies and Shine and Fargo and all that things when everyone decided the you know, the good movies are indie movies. I think
except for Jerry Maguire.
Right. I think if this movie was made in the mid 90s, it would have been a sensation. And I think in the late 90s, after the indie movement had kind of matured to the point where, you know, you're getting real money, you're getting, you know, big stars in this movie, yeah. Being John Malkovich is an indie movie, it kind of got lost. It was too small for 1999.
I fully agree. Yeah. I also think that the, you know, I have you seen North Fork by any chance?
No, North Fork, but
not North Fork. Yes, I literally have the DVD sitting on.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, you can borrow it. Like.
Well, we'll do a trade when I get you Breakfast of Champions.
Breakfast of Champions. I genuinely, I'd like to rewatch that movie because I remember watching it. Because again, like this movie had buzz around it, right? Like it didn't totally blow up. But like there was a buzziness around these guys as to like what's possible, right? Like, mm-hmm. again, similar to a Pie, which was so low budget and everyone was kind of like, wait a second, what's this guy's deal? And then he does Requiem. And obviously, you know, Aronofsky has this huge career.
Yes, I think
there was a little bit of like, could these guys be like that? So they got some real money with North Fork. And a solid cast and just ultimately made a movie that's just sort of just doesn't really exist. And unfortunately, that was just sort of, you know, the beginning.
Yeah,
of
the end, yeah. I mean, Pi.
Yes.
Is going to get noticed at any time because it's so different from what everyone else is doing. And it doesn't matter that it cost. Yeah, it doesn't matter that it cost $80,000 or whatever it is. Yeah. It's like Blair Witch. It's like some of these movies, you know, are just very loud, but this movie is very quiet and you really have to be in the mood for it. And by 1999, and we know better than anyone, they don't have movies like this. No. This just, the indie movement had just matured or evolved past the $500,000 film. So it just kind of got lost. And these guys in the process got lost. Now, I mean, they made this, another movie, I can't remember what it is. Should look it up. Then, this can't be that hard. I will look it up for you.
Okay.
So they made this, a movie called, Jackpot. The movie called The Good Thief. So North Fork was their fourth movie.
Wait, The Good Thief was, were they in The Good Thief?
Martin, no, you're right. They're actors in that. So they made this, Jackpot as director, Michael directed that, and they wrote The Jackpot together.
Yeah.
Which actually seems great. John Grease, who is in this movie briefly, plays
great
a,
in his like one scene is great. In
this who plays a, like kind of a karaoke singer who's not very good, who goes from bar to bar. I want to watch that. Then, they got their chance after North Fork with, of all movies, The Astronaut Farmer.
Oh, right.
And The Astronaut Farmer is
in that again?
Billy Bob Thornton.
Oh, right.
Billy Bob Thornton, Virginia Madsen.
I do remember this movie.
Bruce Dern and Tim Blake Nelson. And it's a $13 million movie. And, you know, let's see. It didn't particularly do.
I'm looking it up.
Terribly with critics, and it didn't do
it didn't bomb, but it didn't make a lot of money either.
It just kind of feels like it almost feels like it was a half measure where first of all, The Astronaut Farmer, I can't think of a fucking less exciting studio movie possible. Right? A movie that I would want to watch less. I couldn't imagine. And
for those who don't know, it's about a Texas rancher who attempts to construct a rocket in his barn and launch himself into outer space.
That's right. The Astronaut Farmer.
Yeah. It's a very literal title.
Yes.
The most literal title.
Yeah. It's it's like the snakes on a plane.
Yeah.
It's
tired of these astronaut farmers.
Yeah. Tired of these motherfucking astronauts. Those motherfucking
on their
farmers.
Motherfucking farms.
I don't know what I'm getting at. I'm getting at
no,
these guys
no,
had,
I think,
these
I
guys had their chance
they this didn't is really bit, yeah. blow it, but like yeah. also it just kind of feels like, why even give them $13 million? This isn't what they need to do. Give them $13 million for one movie. I would give them $13 million and have them make 13 movies and then just like see what happens.
Well, I first of all, I completely agree with you, but also I feel like you're absolutely right that like North Fork had a budget of $1.9 million. It made $1.6 million. Astronaut Farmer had a budget of $13 million. To your point, this is like, you're in the quote unquote big time now, right? Like we're giving you a lot of money.
$13 million for a movie about a guy who tries to send himself in outer space. There is a world where that works. Truly.
Truly, sure. Here's the thing. There is a straight line to be drawn between Twin Falls, Idaho, North Fork, and Astronaut Farmer, in the sense that thematically, aesthetically, there's a lot of sort of, you know, the end of Twin Falls, Idaho ends sort of in a very kind of dusty open spaces, what have you. There is aesthetics that I understand. The Polish brothers wrote The Astronaut Farmer, right? Like this wasn't something that they, you know,
from a book.
I guess what I'm getting at is on paper, I understand why these guys want to make this movie. And I understand why they thought it could be a good movie and could be a movie that kind of put them in the next echelon. But I also understand why it's the movie that didn't do that. Right. Like I'm looking at this Wikipedia page and it's like, there's no there. It premieres at the Mill Valley Film Festival, which is a film festival I've never heard of. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Mill Valley Film Festival.
Of course not. I might be wrong about that. It might not be from a book.
It's based on an article about a real guy.
Okay.
I don't know. I guess it's a California film festival. Long story short, you know, it just doesn't do anything. It's just a movie that doesn't really exist. It's unfortunate that these guys didn't get there for them. Cause I do think there's something there.
What would you do if you were them? If you
truthfully,
meanwhile, like Michael's also married to Kate Bosworth through all of this.
Yes. Was. So there's, they're no longer, but yeah.
They're no longer, but there's some money in that household now. So he does. So I'm not saying they should go put their own money up, but I am saying like he's not starving. He's not worried anymore. So there is some like he probably could have like.
I think you kind of hit the nail on the head, which is this movie came out too late, right? If this movie comes out a few years earlier, it's probably splashier and there's more options for them. But unfortunately, it comes at a little too late and the industry doesn't really know what to do with them. You know, Paramount Vantage or Paramount Classics, I think, is what puts out North Fork. There's, again, like the indie movement's shifting and changing. It's not what
it was. Over, dude. It's crazy. So. Like we never really talk about this, but it was as fast as this, like the last three, four years of streaming. Where in 95, the indie movies that broke through for the most part were movies that were made for like $2 million or less. Yeah. Yep. And by like 99, really look 98, fucking Shakespeare in Love is considered an independent film.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And Shakespeare in Love is made for about $30 million. So it's just like you have like the Miramaxification of this thing. Has just, you know, where Miramax is like pretending to be an indie studio, but is an actual studio owned by fucking Disney, putting a lot of money into this stuff, has pushed out actual indie filmmakers. And this is something that I talk about all the time. I talk about this is why I bitch about the Independent Spirit Awards all the time, is that there is superhero movies, large action movies, there is Oscar bait, and there are indie films. Yep. And Oscar bait is now stuff that's made for like $30 or $40 million or less. And indie films are movies that are made for $1 million or less, and no one ever sees them. No one ever sees them. They don't even acknowledge them. They like 1 out of 100 maybe get like any play anywhere. And if that, it's usually a fucking horror film on Shudder.
And it's like these.
I do think that there are the Sean Bakers of the world, where you make a tangerine on an iPhone and it turns into a thing. But to your point, they're few and far between. I do think that, you know, you're absolutely right. You know, you look at what the Weinsteins did, which started as acquisitions. It started as combing through film festivals, finding movies, distributing those films, building a brand off of that. And then they're just a studio, right? Like, then they're just a studio like everybody else. And yet they still have this,
extremely well-funded studio.
Yeah. But I do think that, you know, to answer your question as to what they should have done, what would you have done if you were? I mean, the problem is that ultimately, you know, TV wasn't what TV is now back then. You know what I mean? I think that, you know, there's a world where the Polish brothers could have made a limited or could have made an interesting, you know, streaming series or something like that. The problem is there was just kind of nowhere to go. And then on top of all of that, I don't know that there was as much there as we would have liked, which I think is maybe the most damning thing that can be said.
Well, we've moved past even a world where they could make a limited, right? Or a TV show. Like, I mean, they could, I'm not saying they couldn't, but no one would care. Because now limiteds are like the thing about Pam that are, you know, major fucking shows for the networks they're on, made for a ton of money, or Ryan Murphy stuff, or et cetera, et cetera. There was like the moment where IFC put out things like, what was the IFC show that people loved?
What's going on?
We're such great podcasters.
The IFC show
about the guy who got out of jail.
Oh my God. It's like one word.
Yeah. It's like retribution. Rectify.
Rectify.
So movies like shows like that, that's like Rectify feels very similar. Like I watched that season. I did like it too. But IFC put out stuff like that here and there. Even HBO put out stuff like that. Even Stars put out stuff like that. There was a period where you had these smaller scale, human sized TV dramas. And I would even count in some international stuff like Top of the Lake felt like kind of in that same vein, and British stuff felt like in that same vein. But now, who's excited about a Polish Brothers movie? You know, like who's excited about a Polish Brothers show?
It's just a bummer. I do think, though.
You want to hear the real bummer?
Sure.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Did you look up their 2020 film? Or Michael Polish's 2020 film?
No.
You want to blow your brains out?
Do I want to?
I'll just tell you about it.
Yeah, I'm looking.
I'd rather just tell you about it. You'll enjoy it.
Is this Force of Nature that you're talking about?
It is Force of Nature.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Yeah, I'm looking at the poster now.
2020 film starring Emile Hirsch, Kate Bosworth, and Mel Gibson.
Two canceled people.
It looks amazing, obviously. It's about a hurricane.
It looks amazing.
Puerto Rico. Griffin buys all the meat available at a market. I mean, like, I'm sure
you
it's
see
great.
The budget on this thing?
The budget is $23 million and it made $600,000. What is this? What the fuck?
Yeah. I mean,
and it holds an approval rating of 6% on Rotten Tomatoes.
But
I mean, to be fair, it was released in 2020, so that's why it only made $600,000.
That's true. But I don't even know if it was gonna be released in its debut weekend. It was the third most rented film on iTunes
and fifth on Fandango Now.
Fifth, well, that's pretty impressive. All that means it had 12 rentings. It's crazy.
I mean, this movie, this is, yeah, I mean,
force of nature. When the perfect crime meets the perfect storm. I'm very into that as a tagline.
Yeah, I'm not into this.
Like the hurricane heist, like which I never saw, but sounded like, yeah, so it's a great time to pull off a heist. But this is what this
is
fucking sensitive genius is doing now. He's working with bad people against the clock. The year before,
and he made a movie with,
you know, actually wonderful people. Yeah, Diana Agron, who I love. No, Against the Clock was this 2000. And,
oh.
I have to take like deep breaths when I look at this because it's so sad. 2009, he made a movie called Against the Clock that Wikipedia doesn't even deign to give a fucking synopsis of. So I will glean what I can from the poster. It stars Diana Agron from Glee, who should have been the biggest star in the world.
How she is in this. She's great in Shiva Baby, though.
She's the best. She's Jewish. It's amazing. Diana Agron, Mark Polish, Justin Bartha, and
I can't read what it says either.
Something Andy Gart. I don't know if this is as Agent Murder Face. Andy Garcia, who like also shouldn't be in movies like this. But what else?
His character's name is Detective Gerald Hotchkiss.
Hotchkiss. Sure. Oh, does that just rolls as off the Gerald Hotchkiss?
Yep.
Andy Garcia, and then 90 Minutes in Heaven.
I'm looking at this too now.
What are you doing, dude?
A Christian drama starring Hayden Christensen, Kate Bosworth, Dwight Yoakam.
The resignation in your voice is a Christian drama.
Yeah, it is the first film by Giving Films, a sister company to the retail chain Family Christian Stores.
It's a heaven movie.
It's a heaven movie. I mean,
it's a heaven movie.
I don't know. Amnesiac. He does in as well. Kate Bosworth in all of his movies. I think Kate Bosworth really thought that this guy was going places.
I don't know. Kate Bosworth had a really weird fall from grace too.
She did. What happened? What happened to her career? What do we think happened there?
You know, I don't know the answer. I met on this show. It was a crackle show.
Yeah, what was it called?
Crackle show. It was called The Art of
The
Art of More. And it was about it wasn't an art thief. It was like an art. It was an art show. It was an art show. And it was very weird because it was like the TV version of these movies. It had Dennis Quaid like kind of in that lull for him. And it had Cary Elwes also in a bit of a lull. And it had Kate Bosworth, who I was like, you shouldn't be in a crackle show. Like, you're Kate Bosworth. Like, you. And it had this thing where
it's still Alice.
Well, the thing about that show in that moment was like, if you put this cast on an NBC show, I'd completely buy it.
Yeah.
At that moment, right? Like, these are real people. Like, so this is when I figured out what Crackle's game is, which is just overpaying for these people and not paying writers anything, as I found out intimately about 2 years later.
I just want to talk about Kate Bosworth for a second here, because I do feel like the moment that it all kind of goes to shit for her is when they don't make a sequel to Superman Returns.
I know. So I really liked her as Lois. 06,
and then it's 20. That movie 21, which I heard was fun.
She was probably my favorite part of it, by the way.
Yeah, she's great in it.
Yeah,
and then she's in that movie 21 about the kids, the college kids. That,
yeah, I saw that movie. It's which is fun. It's kind of a weird, you know. It's not. It's weird that movie is, written and produced by the same people who did The Social Network. That is a real fucking case study of what a David Fincher brings to material.
Oh,
because 21 is just a romp, basically.
Yep.
A barely competent romp, and you can see a better movie in there, right? You can see like for whatever reason, the director or the filmmakers thought like, yeah, this is just kind of a fun movie that completely lives on the surface.
Yep.
Ben Mezrich, the guy who wrote it, I think was like, foreseeing crypto, foreseeing edgelords, foreseeing people who think they are smarter than the system and can take them. And there is a, if you remade this movie now, or Taking Down the House, so I think was the Bringing Down the House was the move, was the book. Yep. If you use that as source material now, I think you could tell the story of the last 15 years as much as The Social Network does, because there is this thing, this
21.
Like,
I'm trying to see. Oh, it was Robert Lucetic. Yeah.
It's
Alan
it's,
Loeb.
Yeah. It's competent, but it could have been brilliant.
But then she's in the Straw Dogs remake, which I never saw, with what's his face, James Marsden.
Marsden. Yeah, you don't want to be in the Straw Dogs remake, in my opinion.
Yeah. And then it's nothing. It's just a bunch of just nothing. It just makes me sad because I like Kate Bosworth. I think she's
me too.
I Win a Date with Tad Hamilton's a fucking great movie. She's great in Blue Crush. Yeah. She's like, she's really, really charming and lovely. And I don't know, it all got away from her.
So this movie, this kind of fulcrum point for both her and Michael Polish is this movie called Big Sur, which is about Jack Kerouac. And it seemed like it was like kind of Polish's return to a smaller movie, a smaller budget. I mean, this was a 73-minute movie when it ran at Sundance, which is crazy. And
it's based on the Kerouac book, right?
Yes, yeah. It's based on Kerouac's life.
Yeah,
and it just didn't
make any impression.
It didn't make any impression. It has 42 on Rotten Tomatoes. You know, obviously the forever disclaimer that Rotten Tomatoes doesn't mean everything, but it does speak to something that people were not fucking enthralled by this film. And from there, it just seems like both of these people, Michael Polish and his wife, Kate Bosworth, became paycheck people, which is a shame.
It is a shame. It's really interesting because like you look at Twin Falls, Idaho, and this is an examination of like, this is a small movie. This is a quiet movie. All the things that you said, right? So for a movie like this to make a splash in any real way is a testament to the fact that the movie is good, right? Like that's hard to do. But it's also, this is obviously a prime example of like what Hollywood can do to you if you're kind of at the wrong place at the wrong time. Because it does feel like they don't know what to do with them. You know, the Polish brothers are clearly a very specific kind of esoteric lane that they just don't fit anywhere. And it's a bummer. So what I do think is that this movie looks amazing for $500,000. I know you watched it on a shitty YouTube version, but it's exceedingly well shot. It's really beautifully made. So you got to really hand it to them on that. I do think that the movie's probably a little too simple for its own good at times, in terms of just it's not, you know, there's not a ton going on. Now, admittedly, like that's you know, one of its strengths, but also can be seen as a weakness. But there's a real tenderness for the characters, and I do think that transcends any of its weaknesses. But all that being said, there's not much plot to talk about, but essentially the film opens with Penny showing up at the hotel. She meets Blake and Francis. She does say, "I have a doctor friend who can help maybe find out what's wrong." I think I know what's wrong, Penny. I don't know that I need a doctor to tell me that twins.
That's not what you meant. He's sick.
Well, Francis is sick.
Francis is sick, and her doctor friend is a John. So,
right.
And the whole thing, I think, was kind of interesting. But and I think that
I do like that the actor that played the doctor, who I've seen before, and I can't.
He was great.
He was great. Yeah,
he was great. There's a kind of respect and humanity. Sex workers and people who frequent sex workers,
yes, totally,
that you almost never see. Like,
I agree this with guy that
100%. This guy is not a quote unquote bad guy because it sometimes uses, you know, the services of Penny. In fact, he's kind of loveling.
and really sweet. Yeah,
I don't disagree with anything about what you're. Why do I need to know who the actor is, though, because it's actually driving me a little bit crazy. So bear with me a second, because I do want to find out who he is. He's been in stuff, and I'm just, his name is Patrick Bauchot. Carnival. He was in, he was the father in Panic Room.
Oh, okay. I like him. He's a handsome guy.
He's a good looking guy. Cool. But yeah, so, then we have like a Halloween party, which is a nice little set piece thing where they go to the Halloween party and everyone's
clever. It's clever enough. And
it's a way for her to get them out of the house, out of the hotel room, out into the world. Mm-hmm. I appreciated her kind of taking down her friend and being like, this is the one day of the year where they can actually act like normal people. Mm-hmm. Don't take that away from them. Like, that was a really nice scene. Yeah. I thought that, as you mentioned, John Grease as this kind of lawyer pimp kind of character.
He was like, it's interesting. Yes. I think he was a lawyer pimp who also had aspirations of like being legit.
Yeah. No, totally. Yeah.
Right. Like, yeah. Yes, I think he was, John Peters was a hairdresser who's like, I'm going to be a producer one day. I think he's like, if I catch the right rocket, yeah, I can make you guys something. So yes,
he sees these twins as a real,
gold mine,
golden goose, if you will. Leslie Ann Warren plays their mom has a really beautiful scene with
the great Penny. Leslie Ann Warren.
Who is in The Limey as well, obviously in '99.
And of course in, Color of Night.
Sure. Everyone's favorite movie, Color of Night. She's great. She's got one really solid, really good scene where she kind of gives us the backstory on the delivery of these twins and what that did to her emotionally and the fallout from it. And then, you got this, as we mentioned in the Ebert review, there's this really beautiful bicycle scene, which is sort of led into with, I might argue, is the most haunting scene in the film, is when they're being wheeled into surgery.
Yeah.
A really powerful, sad sequence.
Yeah, he's holding, Blake is holding on and trying not to go in there. And I mean, why wouldn't he? On one hand, they're given basically Francis is going to die. And Blake is given a 50% chance of surviving. Yeah. And, I think the movie did an incredible job of having, so they're getting wheeled into surgery and Blake is reaching for anything to try to stop them from like literally grabbing onto things to stop them from going in. And they did an incredible job of making it not about Blake wanting to survive, more about Blake wanting to, I think, go out with Francis, which is something they say earlier, which is, essentially we checked in together, we're going to check out together. Yeah. And it's interesting that the thing about the two of them riding bicycles was something Ebert hit on, because I don't like that thing.
You didn't like that moment?
Because I think it undercuts the central premise of the movie, which is, or the central idea, which is we checked in together, we checked out together, I wouldn't know any different. I wouldn't know any different than being, conjoined to this person. That is Blake in particular, who's given more agency because he's healthy the whole movie. That is his way of going through life. And like, I'm not convinced that, I believe there are some people who might want a world where they are riding a bike alone. I'm not convinced this guy does. And, it's like, I'm not convinced that that is his version of happiness. I think his version of happiness is not being separated from his brother. It's growing old with his brother. I think he's, my sense is that he has accepted that this is his life. And whether or not he likes it or hates it or whatever it is. And I understand, the urge as a person who does not have a conjoined twin to be like, of course you'd want to be separated, but I'm not convinced of that. And I think that they do that over the course of the movie. And I think that is a bit of a half measure, almost like a signal to us normies that he wants what we want, what we would want.
I do think that I didn't read the bicycle thing as perhaps binary, certainly as Ebert did. I didn't necessarily see it as a dream sequence of
I didn't either. Maybe okay. I'm reacting more to Ebert's.
Yeah, Ebert sees it more response, as like a wish almost or a dream.
More, yeah, because it almost seemed more like it came from Penny's point of view.
Or just society's point of view. Like there's an element I watched it as just like this is what we think they wanted. Now, admittedly, it does get very sort of symbolic as they're literally kind of like we see one up on a hilltop and we're starting to sort of see. So to me, it's more, I don't know. I didn't see it as literal as Ebert did. Right. I saw it more as either. Yeah. So but it didn't bother me. It's a nice thing that I'm not sure is totally necessary or totally sticks its, you know, reason for existing, but you know,
it just doesn't seem of this movie because I think the last scene is so beautiful. Yes. The last scene where Penny goes and tries to find them after they've kind of disappeared and finds them back at a farm where they also kind of keep the carnival performers, and she finds Blake alive. We didn't know if he survived until that moment, with one arm, one
part of the leg.
Part of a leg. The idea was that that the leg was his to control, and Francis's leg was kind of like wrapped around it, and it had kind of formed, but it hadn't, correct, you know, separated.
Yeah.
So they amputated that as well, and he survived. And to their credit, they left you with this impression of maybe Blake will be okay because Penny is able to kind of go into this role as his other half. But it's not everything. It didn't end with a kiss. It didn't end with a romantic moment. It just ended with a beautiful shot of the two of them kind of walking together. Which was super appropriate for this film. Very,
for
like,
sure.
A very like reserved, restrained way to end this movie.
And sort of this, you know, their dialogue, their last sort of couplet is, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but something along the lines of, you know, an unhappy ending isn't necessarily an unhappy ending. It's just where the author decides to stop telling the story.
And that was Blake's idea the whole time. I think there are things like that. And frankly, I think that that's a little heavy-handed, and I think there were some images that were a little heavy-handed, like literally when they are, you know, getting separated, you cut to Penny separating chopsticks.
Yeah, there's
some stuff that's just exactly. There's just some stuff that just feels like, you know, not with maybe with a stronger editor or producer, they might be like, you don't need that. But I'm more than willing to forgive it because absolutely, the heart, its heart is completely in the right place.
Yeah,
and these characters so seriously. Like this is like, I would show this to film students and be like, sincerity wins. Like, please be sincere. Sincerity, 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 sincerity. Irony is the worst, unless you like are really, really smarter than everybody else. Like, if you're truly smarter than everybody else, then you can be ironic. But otherwise, like,
yeah,
be sincere.
No, I think this is
and honest and emotional.
I agree with you that film students should watch this film to see what you can, you know, what you can accomplish with $500,000. Today what you could accomplish with $500,000 as opposed to, you know what I mean? Like, now this obviously would be shot on digital. It would, you know, I'm sure it would still look quite good.
You could do, the only thing is you got to figure out how to build that thing that they have put themselves in to be a conjoined twin, which is compelling. I think that I think it's believable, and you only see it once. You only see their shared body once, but outside of that,
I'm with you. I think that this movie, I think it's a special film. I think it's a bummer that it kind of exists in some weird purgatory streaming wise. I don't know why you can't rent it or buy it on iTunes or Amazon. I think that's a shame. We've stumbled across this, you know, several times over the course of this podcast. You know, your Girl on the Bridges and what have you, films that deserve to be last night, what have you.
Yeah, I think this falls into that category
of like, these are movies that yeah, that just, they deserve to have a proper fucking release. Like, I think it's crazy that they don't have it.
I also think its title is a bad one.
It's not great.
It's a little Good Will Hunting in, you know, it's,
if it's the bad version of Good Will Hunting.
It's very Good Will Hunting. I'm sorry, is the worst fucking title of all time. Yeah. But this is, you know, Twin Falls, Idaho. For those of you not aware, has nothing to do with the city Twin Falls, Idaho. There's not even a comma actually in the title.
Correct.
So it's twin because they're twins. Falls because their last name is Falls, and Idaho because they're staying at the Hotel Idaho. Reason it's so bad, even it's a horrible title, but the real reason it's so bad is because in the wake of Twin Peaks, it makes you think it's a different kind of movie into it. Now it teases that, I think it's playing with that, but it also, you know, to me, there has never been, nor never will be, a successful Lynchian movie made by anyone other than David Lynch. It's like, you just can't do it. Now, I'm not saying it's impossible, but I am saying, like, David Lynch imitators make me want to vomit usually.
Well, it's
I fear that that's what we were getting into the entire, a movie that echoes Twin Peaks in its title.
Yeah,
literally, like, using the name of a town with the term twins in it, that's about conjoined twins. I'm like, this is going to be something that will not make me feel good.
Yep.
And it made me feel not good, but in all the right ways.
You know, the Lynch thing I want to unpack for a quick second here, because I do think it is something that ever since David Lynch came on the scene, there have been imitators, right? There have been people that have tried to sort of do what he does. And the reason that David Lynch is David Lynch is because it's not a bit.
That's exactly right, dude. You just nailed it.
Lynch is David Lynch. And when he talks and when he's doing what he's doing, this is from his soul. He is a fucking artist. Other people trying to be quirky and weird.
Oh,
it's just
totally
It's just not. I do think that, but to your point, I think they're cognizant, and by them I mean the Polish brothers, of what they're trying to do. They're trying to swerve away from him, even though they kind of lean into it in the beginning. The title is bad. The title is bad for a bunch of reasons. What you said about Twin Peaks, but also it doesn't elicit anything good. It's all boring. Like, these are three things that just don't work. It's unfortunate. I mean,
nothing's worse than Idaho. It's funny. I'm trying to I'm trying to figure out what the best, like, Lynchian movie is, you know, that
rips him off. I see.
That is trying to do Lynch, directed by Lynch. And I'm Googling it a little bit, and the movies giving me are not satisfying. Not that they're bad movies, just that they're not, like, I mean, there's an IMDb list. The top one is Donnie Darko. It's like, that's not Lynch. Like, that's just that. That's not Lynchian.
Yeah, it's not totally Lynchian. I do feel, because here's the thing about Lynch too, is that, like, he's like a fucking crazy weird Terrence Malick, right? Like, because
I totally agree with you,
right? Like, there's this very kind of, like, dreamlike.
Yeah.
Stream of consciousness kind of vibe to him. So I don't know that, like, there's other people that are trying to do that. Really?
It's because, and it speaks to this Polish Brothers thing. Maybe this is the best fucking Lynch movie that's not a Lynch movie. Because, like,
maybe, yeah.
His movies are, David Lynch's movies in general are deeply fucking sincere.
Yes.
It's like you said, it's not a bit. Yes. They're deeply sincere. And I think people who haven't really, like, engaged with him and are just like, this is the wild guy who has Dennis Hopper inhale fucking, you know, whatever he's inhaling. And he does crazy, you know, murder shit. And I think people think that David Lynch just means weird. And also, like, I fear that David Lynch has given some dummies a little bit of carte blanche when it comes to like not actually wrapping their stories around something that makes sense to them. You know, it's like, well, you know, what does it matter? Like Lost Highway didn't make any sense. I love Lost Highway. Who knows? But all these movies are like so incredibly heartfelt that I think like this, if this isn't really Lynchian, you know, it's only Lynchian in the way that like The Straight Story is Lynchian, right? But like this, or The Elephant Man, actually, interestingly enough. But in terms of like a real like Lynchian movie, I don't know if anybody would even dare. I don't know if anyone good would even dare. You know?
Two things. I agree with you. Two things come to mind. The first is, I do think that A24 has sort of made a cottage industry of art horror films that could, you know, I mean, your Ari Asters, your Robert Eggers, these are guys that do exist a little bit in the Lynchian world. Oh, so I was thinking
Midsommar a little bit.
Right.
And I think you're probably even more right about Eggers.
The other movie that comes to mind, and we talked about this when we did the episode, but Eyes Wide Shut does have Lynchian vibes at times. It doesn't go full bore nightmare in the way that Lynch can, and it's not as sort of quote unquote weird and quirky, but there's definitely the dreamlike quality, the way people speak in it do have Lynchian vibes.
I think Lynch could have made Eyes Wide Shut and it would have been a very similar film.
Right. But Cooper couldn't make a David Lynch movie. I agree with you.
Cooper could have, and you know,
I don't think he'd want to.
He does his own thing. I mean, he's Kubrick. Yeah. You know, Kubrick, like it's funny that we say that, right? I think Lynch can make a Kubrick film, Kubrick couldn't make a Lynch film, and Kubrick is a superior director to Lynch. So figure that one out.
No, it is the thing about Lynch that's so interesting is how, like, you know, art snobs, film Twitter, what have you, that have wrapped their arms around Lynch in so many ways, understandably, because he's such a compelling and interesting artistic visionary. And yet at the same time, I do feel as though what he does is so specifically him that other people that even try to take a run at it are just doomed to fail.
There are just some people that you kind of should just let be. I think John Waters is like that too.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that, like, and even Tim Burton, though, you know, some people come closer to Burton, but like Sonnenfeld has come kind of close to him here and there.
Sure.
But there are just some people who you shouldn't follow down their alleys.
Yeah.
You know, if you're inspired by these, you know, kind of visionary auteurs, the inspiration should be to create your own lane completely. If you're that kind of person. Otherwise, you are going to fail. There's a reason why Tim Burton movies make $300 million and Tim Burton imitators never make any kind of fucking dent whatsoever. It's because, like, only he can do his thing the way he can do it.
Yeah, I agree with you. John Waters and David Lynch are two such specific voices that you're never going to get there.
Good luck.
You shouldn't even try. Do you want to rate this?
I want to rate this.
You go first.
Before the podcast, I gave it a 90. After the podcast, I'm going down just a little to an 88. I still think it is one of the best movies we've done this year. And a movie I could see myself watching again. And nothing like it. You know, to make a movie for $500,000 that is ultimately kind of low concept. That works as well. It is a feat of conception and execution, and I give them all the credit in the world. I'm sure they're too far gone at this point because they're making, you know, Force of Nature. But maybe there's a world. Maybe there's a world where, like, you know, they can come back. You know, it's interesting that, like, the guy I think of in terms of a guy that, pardon the phrase, sold out. Is David Gordon Green, who I'm confident whenever he wants could go back and direct a brilliant fucking, you know, A24 movie.
Yeah,
and I wonder if the Polish Brothers could also do that.
I mean, David Gordon Green is such a, he's such a fascinating filmmaker. I mean, to think that his career starts with George Washington and All the Real Girls. And,
yeah.
And, you know, and then he made Your Highness.
Yeah. It's, yeah. Just, I was going to say the getting high in the Middle East. He must be. He must be like someone. It's someone who has those two lanes. And he also made Halloween. Like, he just must be just such a great fucking hang.
He must be
you know, he must be so fucking smart. It's so not precious, and yep. So like, to have such an incredible breadth and depth of insane. knowledge. But like, I think everybody wants this from him. I think everybody wants him, yeah, to make like a fucking masterpiece with some money behind it.
I think there's an inevitability to him. I mean, he's already struck gold a bunch of times in different ways, but like, he's a really special guy. Your Highness, by the way, underrated. I think Your Highness is a.
I don't think he's ever made a bad movie. Like, I don't think he's capable. I don't love Pineapple Express, but like, sure. I think like, hey, dude, look at that. He made That's Joe. Crazy. He just threw Joe out there in the middle, yeah, of like his, like, yep, making the sitter and shit. He's a good guy.
he's a good bro. So in 99, as I mentioned, I saw this film. I liked it. Didn't love it. Probably would have given it like a 65 or a 70. Like, I thought it was fine. Watching it again before this podcast, I went up considerably. I was up at an 80. And now after this, I'd say I'm at an 82 or an 85, somewhere around there. Yeah. I think it is a special movie that deserves people to see it. Like, period. You know what I mean? Like, it is just a bummer that it's hard for people to see it. It's a shame to see where their careers went. But you know, it's a haunting movie. It's a beautiful, tender, sad movie. And obviously, you know, with you having twins, I'm sure that hits a whole other level, but still, it's interesting.
I did the twin draft for the Force 5 pod with our friend Jason.
Oh yes, of course.
Greenberg. Uh-huh. And or not the draft, the list. And I had not seen this. And I guess it's worth saying or worth noting.
That it would be in your five, you think?
Definitely would be in my five. Okay. It would probably be number two.
Wow.
Number one was Adaptation. Sure. And number two was Skeleton Twins. I think this is a better movie than Skeleton Twins. I think it would, yeah, have been number two.
I like Skeleton Twins, though.
It's an excellent movie. Yeah. Excellent movie about boy girl.
What are
twins.
Your other ones on there?
Obviously, Stuck Jack on and you, Jill obviously. Was somewhere in there. Stuck on You did not make the list. His list was amazing. I don't want to give away anything from his beautiful, brilliant list. The Empire Strikes Back was on my list.
Interesting. Okay.
And okay. What was the other one? It was, let me see.
I'm trying to think about movies about twins. I can't even, like, movies about twins. I mean, you didn't put Twins on there. Obviously,
I didn't put Twins on there because it stinks, and I didn't put Dead Ringers on there.
Interesting,
though I had to. All right, so this is my final list: Adaptation, okay, The Skeleton Twins, Social Network, Empire Strikes Back, sure, Jack and Jill. Obviously,
sure.
Jack and Jill was going to be five, no matter what. It was very important. I would have probably knocked.
What about Parent Trap?
Yeah, I don't love it. I mean, I've seen it a lot. I just don't think it's a great movie.
Okay, cool.
I probably would have knocked Social Network, or I probably would have knocked Empire Strikes. I don't know, one of those two off to put this on. Cause like, I think Adaptation, Skeleton Twins, and this are, yeah, great movies that are actually about twins.
I agree.
I think Jack and Jill is also actually about twins. Yeah. Where I think Empire Strikes Back is like barely about twins. And the Social Network, I really hope we should release this late so that it can air first.
I don't want to stomp on that.
But yeah, where the Social Network is not actually about twins, but they're all like, I had one rule, which was essentially like, it can't be where the reveal is that they're twins. It can't
right,
be
right, right, right,
like,
right,
that's not like the prestige. Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is an amazing movie, but like, yeah,
it not treats about twins. Twin,
yeah. It treats twins like they're a magic trick. And like,
they are.
That's. It's right, they are. So
a scientific magic trick, that's a crazy thing.
And Jason, it's true, and Jason, to his credit, had a truly incredible list, but not on that list was the movie that we're doing with him. That's why I brought him in.
Twin Dragons, not
one. Oh, he had a legit crazier movie than Twin Dragons on there.
That's fantastic.
At number three, one of the craziest picks I have ever heard in anything I have ever been a part of.
That's fantastic.
It kind of made me love him for life. It was like, this guy is this guy is all right. You know?
I'm excited to have him on for Twin Dragons, a movie I've never seen. Yeah.
Well, it's actually, I don't know if you know, it's actually a 92 Hong Kong release and a 99 Jackie Chan boomlet American release, which I'm very into.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. I can't wait to have him on for it. But yeah. Listen, we got lots more movies to cover. There's also, I think that Lola wants to come on for Dead or Alive. So we need to, which is, I think, also maybe a twin movie, the Takeshi Miike movie.
Oh, I don't know.
So that's also on a list of strange things to come. So
love weird shit.
Are you looking it up?
We're gonna do two Takeshi Miike movies.
Yeah, it looks gonzo. That looks crazy.
We'll have to really discuss its eligibility because it was a 2001 American release. We'll have to have a conversation.
I thought it was 99
in Japan.
Oh yeah. Well, then maybe we'll figure it out.
We'll have to do it on the Patreon.
We'll do. Sure. Great. All right. Well, that was Twin Falls, Idaho, guys. Thank you for listening.
All right. See you later.
Later, man.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.